Welcome to Two Dope Boys in a Podcast. I'm Phil McKenzie.
I'm Michael Brooks.
Two Dope Boys is a shout out from the margins. Each week we will break down trends using the lens of culture to shed light on what's significant to your future and why. What's up, brother?
How you doing, man? I'm doing well. Trying to kill this cold. Hopefully by the time the people are listening, it'll be done. We have illustrious crew with us.
What's up? I'm Base Gormley.
Welcome back. Thank you for being with us.
Good to be here.
It's been a minute. Before we get to the brand F up of the week, we got to get to a segment that we're going to be doing periodically called the Two Dope Boys Mailbag. We get your emails. Sometimes this will be the Two Dope Boys tweet, the Two Dope Boys Instagram comment, whatever catches our fancy when you communicate with us. This week, it's a hysterical email that was addressed primarily to Phil.
Yeah.
Phil, you got to read it.
And I appreciated the email, actually, because it was funny. It did make me laugh, and I have a pretty thick skin, so it's all good. And this email comes from Kyle, who is a regular, obviously a regular listener to the show.
He does a great job.
He does a great job and thought enough to write in about one of my crates recommendations, which was Infernal Affairs, which I made the clear distinction as being much better than The Departed, which sucked.
Assalamu alaikum, Kyle.
And I and I will maintain that. But we're going to get to Kyle's email. And basically, he starts off, "I'm sorry, but I had to chime in on this because Phil was habitually line-stepping when he said that Infernal Affairs was better than The Departed."
This is already a great email.
Great email, because you said habitual line-stepping, a homage to Dave Chappelle and Charlie Murphy. And that
and also,
whole thing.
It's true.
And it's true. I am a habitual line-stepper. So it's great. Yeah. True, The Departed took the important plot elements from Infernal Affairs, but of course we all know that's not enough to mean the originator is better than the refiner. I have to say I was hoping for a spirited debate about this, but didn't get one because Michael hadn't seen it, and Phil got away with just asserting that Infernal Affairs was better. First off, fuck your bitch and that click you claim. No, but really. The plotting of IA, Infernal Affairs, is basic at best because they're actively aping American cop movie tropes in the hopes that they get U.S. distribution at some point.
Damn.
Yeah, big time.
In your face.
Second, unless you happen to be a native Mandarin speaker, Phil, I'm not sure how exactly you can appreciably judge performances versus American performers. But fuck all that.
I have to say, I agree with Phil.
Infernal Affairs,
much
right?
I have to say, I still haven't seen Infernal Affairs, but I agree with every sentence of that email. That email is brilliant. I believe Kyle is a genius.
The email is a strong, strong opinion, but my personal opinion stands with Phil McKenzie.
Well, I so
busy in the house.
One dope email and me trump you all. And super producer Matt clearly is on my side.
But it's a great
creative
email.
Director Shauna Wan smirking behind the iPhone as he tapes all of this. Follow us on Instagram.
Bad accents and very shallow emotions.
Well, I support good accents and shallow emotions. So I'm 50% on that one. We got to get to the brand F up of the week. Phil, take us there.
Delta Airlines. Oh, Delta.
Whoa.
I always feel like we're somehow talking about an airline company, and
fucking
oftentimes
up.
It's Delta. But basically, Delta had a incident where a passenger got on the flight from Pennsylvania to Atlanta or vice versa, and was berating customers about being Hillary Clinton supporters and letting them know, as if we weren't already aware of our new American nightmare, that Trump is president.
We have this clip for everybody in case you haven't heard it already. People, here it is.
Man. How many people, man?
I have a joke.
Really? Ain't nobody gonna say no shit on this plane?
We can't hear you.
You can't hear me? Donald Trump, baby. That's right. This man knows what's up. We got some Hillary bitches on here. Come on, baby. Trump. That's what I'm talking about. Hey, baby. Donald Trump, it's your presence, every goddamn one of you. If you don't like it, too bad.
I just would like to say really briefly, in super producer Matt's defense, he had been on a really long layover, And we were just talking about how horrible the food is on planes. So he was really upset before this incident, and he's apologized since.
Well, this gentleman is banned for life.
So Matt can't fly Delta anymore.
Matt cannot fly Delta anymore. Yeah.
What is his actual name?
They didn't release his name. No. But Delta chief executive officer, who's his name is Ed Bastiane, said in a letter to employees on Monday, this individual displayed behavior that was loud, rude, and disrespectful to his fellow customers. He will never again be allowed on a Delta plane.
Wow, you're missing out.
Yeah, so that's the the nature of the situation. What really upset me about this is that this guy was originally allowed to fly.
Mm-hmm. And he wasn't kicked off of this flight.
Yeah, he wasn't kicked off of this flight even after this tirade. And clearly, I think that's where the breakdown really happens. Not so much with their apology that this guy can come on, say these things, and then be allowed to continue on to his destination. That's what's problematic, at least to me. But ready to open it up to hear other voices.
When I was little, my dad used to fly a lot. And he told us a story once when he came home about there being a professional wrestler in first class who got loaded and
this is awesome.
Started cheering and chanting very loudly and trying to grab the boobs of the flight attendants. And so they Not had good. To do an emergency landing to arrest the dude and take him off the plane.
Jesus. Was it Arnold Schwarzenegger?
Well, I'm not sure it was an emergency, but they definitely stopped at Chicago or something like that instead of Boston. So as soon as I read this story, I thought of that and thought of the shifted standard in terms of response time that you just referenced.
I think that what struck me about this and why we sort of selected it, because this has been, sometimes we try to pick things that are slightly under the radar, and this has been kind of making the rounds everywhere because it's so obvious and so disgusting. But the sort of contrast point in and of itself, it's ridiculous that he wasn't removed from this plane, but just, excuse me, we've recovered so many stories of, you know, they were removed from a plane for, you know, being black and wearing a t-shirt, for being Muslim and saying something in Arabic. And the contrast of being just completely belligerent and out of control and continuing to fly with those other stories and those sort of contrasting treatments, to me, is the kind of major through line here. And it goes back to, you know, a number of points that we've made, both socially and politically, but also in terms of just doing business and the kind of chronic failures of airlines to be operating well in the sort of current standards and current environment. So I think that the contrast to me is the sort of biggest takeaway and the biggest part of the F up.
Yeah. Flying is already torture. Like, it's already a nightmare on any number of different levels. And, you know, just recently Delta removed a Muslim couple from a flight. This was in the summer, merely for being Muslim. Like, you know, it was like, the flight attendants were like, oh, we're uncomfortable with you sitting on the seat because the man was quote unquote sweating.
Right.
And the woman was talking on a cell phone and she had on a Habib, you know? Right. So it's like, merely for who you are, they're removing you. And then this dude can literally go on a profanity.
Well, he is being himself too.
Yeah. But himself is being rewarded.
Right.
I also think it's a failure of the media coverage because I'm just bored and tired of the inflammatory, you know, this is really not about Donald Trump. This is about an asshole on a plane. And I also think that the fact that we can have a conversation here about the multiple failures of Delta to have a consistent policy and an anti-racist policy, I haven't seen that in any of the coverage of this incident, is bringing up for me this like just bigger circus show that we're in the midst of on a media level, and I'm tired of it.
Word. That is the brand F up. We got to get to what's up.
Now we want to jump to what's up, and our what's up comes from Snap, you know, formerly known as Snapchat, but now officially known merely as Snap, and the rollout that they've had for their new product, Spectacles. Mm. And this is something we talked about, I guess about a month ago,
back into the Two Dope Boys archive if you're new to the Two Dope Boys journey.
That's about track that back a little bit. But I remember we did a show kind of...
Circles Connect.
Yeah, talking a little bit
like
about
the True
Snap
Detective of brands.
And spectacles. And now it's here. And we want to talk about it from a marketing perspective in the sense that their rollout, for those who are not familiar, has been about creating a vending machine that's branded as if it looks like it almost looks like a Minion. Like if I had to describe it
totally
looks like
a minion,
but as vending machine. and they've been placing these in some kind of far out places, primarily in California, but not exclusively in California. And so you kind of get this countdown visual if you have an account with Snap, letting you know sort of that it's coming, the vending machine is coming, and then you get a location tag letting you know where it is. So they create this sort of scavenger-esque demand, which I think has been pretty interesting for a product that's not their main product. I think the way they position this is very clearly different from Google Glass, which was supposed to be a functional tool. And Spectacle, as far as what I've been able to see, has been positioned more as like a toy, an addendum, something to play with, and something that's cool. And that cool factor is what's made it a must-have, so to speak. So, you know, I'm just curious as to this campaign, how it's been launched, how they're rolling it out. Is there a thought process that this is something that could be applicable to other things? Because I feel like they're borrowing from some other areas.
You already
mentioned
sneaker culture.
Sneaker culture, this idea of scarcity.
Yeah, you should elaborate on
has
that.
Has played into that in the sense that, you know, limited edition sneakers, whether those come from Nike, Adidas, and other primary sneaker makers, Reebok, tend to have people waiting online. You're waiting for the drop. There's only X number of those available, and then there's a big resale market afterward. Pokemon Go, which was a big sensation through the spring, summer, and early fall, this idea of scavenging for where this thing is going to be. I think they've incorporated a bunch of different elements that are pretty interesting. And I'm curious as to whether or not that's going to be something that could be applicable to other people in the marketing space.
It seems like a hybrid of the throwback now to the original iPhone release and the gamification that you're talking about. So it's this new, sexy, fun thing, and it has a winning element to it. You can win. You can be the one who has it that no one else has it. But I think one thing they've really tapped into, to your point about the Google Glass differentiation, is that people want the future to be fun. I mean, lately I've been thinking a lot about WALL-E, the Pixar movie, and the spaceship, and how how not futuristic that is in terms of most people's desires and mentality. People want to have fun. They want to like enjoy it. They want to be capturing and going and flowing. And I think that Snapchat, in its original form, was able to do some of that. But this is a new piece of it that makes it even more fun. Even more, I mean, the scarcity is at the core of what Snapchat was original in terms of it's only for X amount of time. And now they've made it a thing you can hold in your hand that has the same kind of futuristic fun quality.
Yeah, those are really good points. I think that, and also, you know, we see the Pokemon Go phenomenon. So the gamification and fun having and fun seeking is essential to it. The contrast to me with Google Glass is fascinating, because part of why Google Glass was so kind of like rightfully mocked and skewered was, you know, the price point, but also, again, this kind of sense of self-seriousness about it. Like, I'm going to wear this ridiculous gadget on my face that's going to like mediate my experience, and it's going to enhance me. And thankfully, there was still enough kind of innate, healthy human response of like, what's not enhancing you? You look like an asshole, right? And it led to great Daily Show sketches and everything else. So they're taking, you know, entirely the opposite track. Like, this is this sort of fun, almost frivolous thing you can engage in. I think on the scarcity front, that's always appealing to people. There's always the kind of notion of being the first to be part of something, to get invited to something, to acquire something, to win a contest, to win a game. On the challenges for them, there are still questions of privacy, of intrusion, how these things will be used, how these things will be deployed. I mean, the New Yorker, as another kind of data point, recently put out a piece on basically Silicon Valley's empathy gap. And we see this across, you know, in a sort of much larger macro sense. There's a driverless car conversation. Now, driverless cars, you know, it's a very complex conversation, and there's benefits and there's disadvantages and everything else, but you're basically seeing a whole sector that's getting driven out of a place where thoughts of the millions of people that are going to be put out of work by it are sort of tertiary and secondary at best. And then if you take it to this kind of level of, you know, snap, we see again something else that could have implications again for privacy, for street harassment issues, for, you know, being filmed or not filmed, that sort of aren't addressed. And I think it's interesting that in this space, the way it runs the gamut so quickly, like something is simultaneously fun, interesting, kitschy, gamified, maybe has some really positive social implications. This type of tool actually could be used in things like street movements and protests and in business in probably really interesting ways. And then there's also these immediate dark sides as well, on like the privacy front, as I've already mentioned, and they're always in play. And at some point, the Valley and these companies in general, I think, are going to have to take a much more kind of anthropological approach to these issues and looking at it sort of more holistically than just a technology that exists and how it can be positioned and delivered. Those are the kind of longer term questions out of it. But I do think for deploying a glass that brings a service, this is the smartest way it's been done so far, and it will prove to be pretty effective.
I love your points, Biz, because A, you mentioned Wally, which I love. I'm getting to your point, dude.
Yeah, well, I want to hear love.
Well, her points involve Wally, and Wally is amazing.
Oh, all right, I'm going to step out of this, because as soon as Wally's mentioned, it's tugged the McKenzie heartstrings.
Exactly.
So I'm out.
You know, it's not easy to do that, but I have a soft spot for Wally.
I feel like
Wally.
Everything I said was really rooted in Star Trek Next Generation.
I'm so upset. He's trying to compliment me, and you just keep plowing over it, man.
Because you just answered your own question.
But it ties to those implications. So it's going to actually bring all of this together in a nice, neat little bow, you know, in the sense that I think there is that fun element, you know, that even the product itself, like from a design perspective, it looks, they look like regular fucking sunglasses, but kind of retro, like kind of 50s, 60s sunglasses, which is cool. Like Google Glass looked like...
Google Glass was like a pocket protector, and this is like a sexy scarf.
On your face.
A pocket protector on your face.
It looked like shit. It
did. You know? That was awful.
It was like the nerdiest Borg shit, apparatus you know? Ever.
It was the worst. It was the absolute worst. Yes. And I think, to your point, the seriousness of Google Glass, the look of it,
right,
made people ask the questions that they haven't asked in the same way,
right,
about spectacles. Because spectacles looks like we went to go see The Blob and now we're going to the sock hop. Like, it kind of looks like that.
Right.
And so you're just like, oh, fun. We're at Big Sur and we got our vending machine.
Not like,
cool.
I am reading your credit rating from my face right now.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But like on a New York City subway...
There's also a consumer assumption that privacy has been relinquished if you're a snapper already. Like, if you remember the origins of this technology, it was like pretty much assumed that most people on there were snapping their junk for at least the first year of the product. So if you've already
and beyond.
Right. But that's my point. Like, I'm saying everybody on there was assuming that from the beginning. I was like, I don't know what that is. I heard that's what they do. So if you've already got this like precedent that people are like, you got it all. It also sets a different tone.
You got it all.
I mean, the perspective is like, it's intriguing. Like when you see like where they're putting the product, like these vending machines are in natural expansive spaces. So you're, you know, people can wear the glasses and get these amazing sort of wraparound panoramic video. But again, you know, we New Yorkers, like we in Brooklyn, like the implications of this on a New York City subway train are a little different.
Absolutely.
you know.
Yeah, the spatial setup is really different.
Really different. Yeah. Like in terms of like the ogling, the kind of the sexual harassment that people face. Like,
I want to talk to the developer who's building the thing that shuts it down when you walk by. You know, like I have a chip in my pocket, and everybody who's filming me when I walk by, it shuts down. I want to meet those guys.
Bobby Kennedy, I think he knew he was being recorded when he went into the White House under LBJ, so he kept a scrambler in his pocket.
There you go. I need a scrambler.
That's brilliant.
A spectacle scrambler.
Yeah, we need a technology scrambler.
We do, but I think this is the broader problem, though, with all of the, like, I get that there's consumer buy-in, but first of all, there's obviously an innate difference between going onto a platform, downloading an app, and choosing to some degree how you want to sort of use it. As soon as it's in public space in physical life, and you're, you know, like you're saying, like you, it could be shot of you regardless, right? Like you're in a Snapchat world even without buy-in. And I think that that's why we need to start reframing some of these tech conversations from a question about consumer choice to really public implications, because that's ultimately where these things are leading to. And as long as everything is still sort of framed or burdened on consumer choice alone, we're not going to start having the kind of business ethics and policy frameworks that we're going to need to actually govern these things, because it's still going to just sort of be flipped back on, like, well, you know, you're sort of in this game to some degree, so you know, if you want to opt out, it should be on you, which is going to be, first of all, innately increasingly much more challenging. And I think even like, yes, like a scrambler or a shut off the app thing is a great business idea and people should be working on it. But it's a questionable proposition that someone should have to buy a product to opt out of an engagement in a public space that they don't want to be in. So I think that we need to take on, and Silicon Valley needs to have a much more holistic view of what kind of governs this and how products are designed and how they're self and regulated from a policy perspective too.
Kamala Harris was big on a lot of this stuff, and I think it's interesting.
She's the new senator from California.
Yeah, and I went to a talk at Ford with her and a bunch of other people about regulation issues on this kind of technology. And I'm interested to see. I actually don't know who's taking over for her seat, but interested to see.
She was Attorney General of California.
Yeah.
Okay.
To see how her, you know, that vacancy opens up a different kind of. It opens up a spot. I don't know who's taking it over, but I think that person is kind of the crowned jewel on this kind of regulation because of the just volume of what comes out of the valley. So we'll see.
And she's also a Howard grad. HU?
Glad we got it in.
I don't really like her anymore. All right, we got to get to what's next. All right, so now we got to get to what's next. And we're continuing on our theme of cities. And I also want to apologize to all listeners if you can pick this up. I am recovering from a really bad cold and I might be messing my flow up a little bit here. But this is a story from the Peer-to-Peer Foundation, which is a really good resource on commons issues, innovation, futures, and sort of those sort of general areas. And it's written by David Bollier. And it's on Barcelona's brave struggle to advance the commons. And I'm going to quote from this piece and open the conversation up. Barcelona's city government is led by a former housing activist, Ada Kalu, who was elected mayor in May 2015. She's a leader of the movement that became the political party Barcelona in Common. Once in office, Kalu halted the expansion of new hotels, a brave effort to prevent quote-unquote economic development, i.e. tourism, from hollowing out the city's lively, diverse neighborhoods. As a world city, Barcelona is plagued by a crush of investors and speculators buying up real estate and making the city unaffordable for ordinary people. I mean, obviously, that's a very global story in terms of real estate speculation inequality. there's also been innovation in areas including broad access to broadband telecommunications. There's a citywide renewable energy co-op in Catalonia, and there's also different forums that the city is building to sort of engage with citizen participation in budgeting and other areas like that. And we talked recently on the show about cities as sites of progress, sites of alternatives to a Trump agenda, alternatives to a sort of more global far-right agenda, because that isn't just sort of succeeding electorally in the United States, it's succeeding electorally globally. And even as we made that point, Phil really kind of rightly pointed out that even quote-unquote progressive cities in the United States are still really very much plagued by inequality issues, housing crises, and affordability, which sort of squeeze out the opportunities for middle and working class people, but also for the types of things that kind of generate energy in cities and are a contrast to the Trump agenda, whether it's new types of business, creative communities, and sort of open and diverse communities as well. And this framework of the commons is another way of sort of framing these issues, so that instead of just thinking in terms of a kind of liberal governance that invests in the public and sort of tames some of the excesses of incumbent businesses, this framework could sort of work in a synchronized way with community organizations, innovative startups, and citizens' needs as a kind of different way of framing and looking at the city and governance in general. So that's what struck me about this piece. And I'll open it up.
I think it's exciting to just think about, because I went to Barcelona last year for the first time. I landed in August, I guess maybe July, and was asking the cab driver just about the development. And I guess I was just a couple months after she took power or took on her role, and basically all the things that he was fearful of and lamenting, this commitment or at least agenda is speaking out against. So in terms of being at least rhetoric example of standing in defiance of these trends, it's exciting. But one of the interesting points from the article you referenced is just talking about how, you know, how these promises and rhetoric come into conflict or tension with the existing powers and the technical functioning of these cities, and how that technicality of what it takes to get something done versus having great ideas is often the biggest hurdle.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, Barcelona is one of my favorite cities. Like, probably might be like, it's definitely my top three. And it's an amazing city. It has such a vibrant energy and perspective. And I think Spain has a lot of that. I think, what's challenging is going to be dealing with like huge systemic issues that are not only partial to their city, but partial to the country as a whole, which are economic issues around very high levels of, youth unemployment and young people, being unemployed. And then larger sort of EU issues. The Commons has many things that are definitely where the future needs to go.
Right.
I think there are bigger conversations to be had that clearly we're seeing. I don't believe that we're seeing a last gasp of neoliberalism. Like, that's very much been bandied about, that, you know, recent political and economic developments, whether that's Brexit, Trump here in the United States, Italy's having a referendum that will have happened by the time this episode airs. It's on Thursday, this parliamentary referendum. And then there's obviously France, what's going on in France. The Dutch have an election, I think, next year with a sort of right-wing nationalist person who's coming up. So there's a lot of ebb and flow as I paint that picture. Despite all of that, I'm not in this camp that neoliberalism is dead or dying. I think it's changing shape. It's very resilient. It's something that is hard to pin down, which makes it hard to fight. Having said that, I do believe that ideas around the commons things that are suggested in this article are the best effective tools toward truly being a remedy, a counterforce to late-stage capitalism, to neoliberalism. And Spain does have a history of this. If you look at Mondragon as a cooperative, they're another organization that we've cited before that has its roots in the Spanish Civil War, sort of 1933, what have you, but has obviously grown, employs over 75,000 people, and doesn't exist in the same capitalist model that we are all accustomed to. So it is proof that these things can work. They can scale to a certain extent if we have to throw scale in as something that's important. And I think Barcelona's efforts toward engaging in this way gives me hope for a city that I really do love.
It's interesting, though, because one of the challenges that are cited in this piece are that a lot of cooperatives are complaining that they can't get procurement opportunities. Like, a lot of the pain points that are going to come up by trying to put this into place, I think, are what need to be paid attention to. Because especially, I mean, in my mind, scale is a big part of neoliberalism. And that push for scale, that push for driverless cars, those things are very closely tied together. Part of the beauty of a city is that it's small enough that it can still be human. Humans aren't scalable. Like, we're just not. That's part of why we are not robots. So the idea that it's going to create specific challenges in Barcelona that might not be the same in any other city, but that needing to honor the fact that those problems are what they need to slow down and take care of in Barcelona. So it's not just a packageable good story about the commons, but actually a different shift in how things are functioning. Because one of the challenges that you come up against, or at least I've come up against in trying to get my toe into the water of the new economy conversations, is that there's a lot of great ideas, and there's really a smaller portion of people that are trying to put them in action. And if the mics are being given to the good ideas, but not to the people who are having those pain points come up in their actual work, then we're just going to be recreating a system that's quote unquote scaling, but isn't actually addressing the root causes. So I just hope that the mic is going to get passed to these people who are calling out, these are the challenges we're having right now, so that the big picture can be a truth as opposed to a good story.
Yeah, I mean, those are all really, really important points. And the only thing that I would, the only two brief things that I would add to this that I think are important is that the common story, and there's other frameworks, but what is relevant about the common story and connects with the show we do here is that it tells a kind of larger alternative narrative to the other ones that are being offered. And in that sense, I do think that's where the sort of idea contingent is really important. And it's a different way of talking about not only politics and governance and civil society, but it's a different way of talking about business and how business can be designed and how business can work with governance. So we've seen, and this is really apparent in Europe right now, I don't know if it's the last legs of neoliberalism, but we've definitely see, at least as a political trend, that the center left is completely collapsing across the Eurozone. And what is mostly scooping that up is the far right. And I talked to Bill Fletcher Jr. recently. I'll shout out the Majority Report because it's relevant. And he said to me that it's not, and I like this assessment, it wasn't that, you know, there are separate tracks here to explain the rise of the far right. Part of it is obviously just the persistent realities that we also talk about here a lot of xenophobia, racism, misogyny. But he also said that, you know, far right populism, he called it the herpes of capitalism. And that, like, when the contradictions in the system are really apparent.
Thanks for that visual.
I mean, don't thank me. We can turn on the news every day and see that visual. So, you know, and the reality of that system at a crisis point, we're either going to evolve to something better, and that involves new ways of doing business, governance, and civil society, or we will still have some form of neoliberalism, but we'll have this very kind of brutal shell over it. And that's obviously what we're seeing with the sort of emergence of you know, Trump America. And so I think these models of commons can invite us to not only rethink cities, but rethink questions like scale, which you both pointed out is really important. Also, even as we embark on our own startups, businesses, what are the goals of those actual businesses? You know, that was another thing that Douglas Rushkoff, I'd recommend people listen back on that conversation. Is the goal of a business to scale and get an IPO, or is it to create a sustainable income for a small group of people and contribute some sort of social value? And re-engineering those questions are really, really important. And the commons does give us a useful framework for that. And
for sure,
it will be something that's next if we're to survive and move on as a species. So that's what's next. We got to get to the crates.
The dinosaurs love to scale.
Did you caught that? Okay, great. I love that. So now we got to get to the crates. This is our picks from really from anything, culture, sports, business, whatever, anything that'll make your life richer, more interesting, more fun. And I'll start with me this week. I have two really quick picks. It just came out. It was in the theaters last year, but there's this movie called Captain Fantastic with Viggo Mortensen. It's a bizarre, really interesting movie. It also hit home for me because I was like homeschooled by weird hippies. So I relate to it. Although I wasn't quite on the regimen that these kids are on in this movie. But it's a sweet movie. It's well shot. It's an interesting doorway into a certain type of counterculture that I think actually we are going to be seeing a really strong resurgence of over the next couple of years. So I'd recommend Captain Fantastic and a book called The Four Futures by Peter Fraze. This is a book that it just comes up in every conversation that I'm in on any of the issues we talk about in this show. And his sort of outline of like basically these four futures that run along scarcity and abundance and hierarchy versus egalitarianism, I think really kind of maps the four options and ways of doing things, in fact, like today and this moment. It's not like a book of speculation. It's a sort of expression of what's happening now carried to its logical fulfillment in the future. It's a great book. I also interviewed him as well, and I think we'll also have him on Two Dope Boys hopefully sometime early in the new year. Biz.
So you know sometimes you have a record in the crates where you only listen to one song, and sometimes you read part of a book multiple times as a student, but you never actually read the book, but you own it.
For sure.
So in the spirit of that, I'd like to welcome anyone to join me in actually reading the full text of Wretched of the Earth by Frantz Fanon. I am digging back into the crates to do cover to cover on that one, and I would love to book club it with any of you who are interested. So hit me up on Twitter, One Witness.
One Witness. I'll read that all with you. That's dope.
I have read it, and I could reread it, though.
Let's do it.
Yeah, I recommend it often, actually, now that I'm thinking about it. Yeah, Frantz Fanon is a genius.
Mm-hmm.
No, but the same. Like, I only read excerpts. I'll read the whole book. That's a good idea.
Yeah, that's one of those you had to read. Like,
yeah,
Black Diaspora 2. That was required reading. So I hadn't. I mean, it's great. It's not like anyone had to force me to do it. It's a great book. You know. And I'm just going to get one thing, and then I could.
Matt, do you want one? Give one?
I don't have
one. Sean, do you have one? All right, cool.
Wally.
Wally.
I can't cry about Wally.
Great movie. Great guy. And the robot, by the way, he just did a great job. It was incredible. Great hospitality. If I could, right, you see Wally. It.
All right. All right, my crates is coming.
Don't have Michael laugh over that, otherwise it's incongruous.
Okay, your crates, haha. I was just playing.
Eva's hot.
All right, my crates is actually a departure from where I usually live, which is like a book or a piece of music or something like that, especially in the nerd world. But this might be nerdy in a different way. I was out shopping, and me and Matt had a little discussion about this off mic before we started recording. I bought a board game this past weekend, where the American version of the game is called Barricade, but it's a game that comes from Germany. I'm not even going to try to say the German name. I'll try. It's Malefiz, I believe, is the German pronunciation, but it's a strategy board game where you have to move your colored pieces from one end to the other, and there's they're white pieces that form barricades that you have to go around, and there's all kind of different rules. It's a four-player game, but you can play it with two people, and it just was a fun way to kind of spend a little bit of this Thanksgiving, this past Thanksgiving weekend. I am a little bit of a board game guy, particularly if there's alcohol as you play them. That always makes it fun. And so for those out there, it's getting to be cold when you might want to take a break from the Netflix and chill and all the rest of that kind of stuff and kind of unplug, I would recommend this game. Get some barricade in your life. So
look, do you want a break from Netflix and chill?
You have to talk.
Yeah. You have to talk. There are dice involved. There's a game of chance, but yeah, the strategy, it's cool, man.
This is for folks who make it through round two of the cuffing season.
There you go.
It's like the guy at the end of the level to see if you can go to level three.
That exactly. Sounds like a total nightmare.
No, go for it. Barricade, strategy game.
All of a sudden I'm playing board games with a girl. I feel like I'm 70. Yeah. I'm just playing. Okay.
Go for it.
No, I would. I'll play it with you though.
There you go.
Yeah. No, well.
In a group.
I don't know. That was the right signal.
Well, then you were just so like,
No, in a group. That's two dope boys, everybody. I want to thank Biz. Thank you for coming
thank
by.
Busy so B. Busy thank B. you both. All
at One
everyone.
Witness on Twitter.
Mm-hmm. Spell it out.
Crew, thank you so much. Shauna Wan, creative director, social media instigator, super producer Matt Leck. We're reading your emails and your tweets now. Try to match the email that Phil got.
Good luck.
We'll read it. Yeah. You are a habitual line stepper.
Follow us. Try to be right this time.
She's going to come in here and question our masculinity.
I'm
going to
get hate mail now.
Yeah. Send hate mail to Biz, to us. Follow us at Two Dope Boys Pod on Twitter, Two Dope Boys Pod on Instagram. Look us up. Get in touch with us if you need anything. We give speeches. We do consulting. We do a lot of stuff. Subscribe to the show if you haven't already. We're at, I think, about 128 reviews on iTunes. Keep them coming. That helps move us up the ranks and new people find out about the show. Phil, always thank you for another expedition, brother.
Peace and hair grease.